I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Muhammad Ali was a transformative and transcendent figure in sports and in American culture. His brash style and constant pronouncements that he was the greatest made him a figure of scorn and derision in much of white America, but many black Americans delighted in his refusal to conform or be acquiescent in the face of white oppression. Ali is the subject of a four-part documentary that will air on PBS beginning Sunday. Today on Midday, I'll speak with two of the film's creators, Sarah Burns and David McMahon, about Ali's athletic gifts, his principled activism, his deeply held religious faith, and his lasting legacy. Plus, Jaywin Russick reviews The Swindlers at Baltimore Center Stage. First, the news.
I done something new for this fight. I done wrestled with an alligator. That's right. I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad. Fast. Last night, I cut the light off in my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
There has never been anyone quite like him. That's Muhammad Ali in September 1974 at a press conference before the Rumble in the Jungle, one of his famous fights with George Foreman, which earned him the heavyweight title, a title he held three times in a long and unparalleled career. Ali was revered by millions and reviled at times by many. He was an extraordinary athlete, a generous philanthropist, a committed and unshakable civil rights activist. And in a new four-part documentary that will air on PBS beginning Sunday, the story of his extraordinary life is told by the extraordinary filmmaking team of Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, and David McMahon. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. I spoke yesterday with Sarah Burns and David McMahon. They joined me on Zoom from their home in New York. Sarah, welcome. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Tom, for having us.
And Dave, good to speak with you as well. Thanks for your time.
Very glad to be here, Tom.
So, Sarah, let me start with you. The beginning of the film, you talk about, actually, it's David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, talks about how Ali, it's easy to remember Muhammad Ali from that sort of iconic image of his lighting the torch at the Olympics just a few years ago, and to forget about what a huge sort of overwhelming figure he was in American culture for so many years before that. Was it his sort of unique standing in American culture that drew you to this project? Why did you decide to take Ali up as your latest subject?
Yeah, you know, he is really unique. That's a good way to put it. I don't think there's ever been anyone like him, and I'm not sure there ever will be again. We first started thinking about this as a subject more than 7 years ago when the writer and journalist Jonathan Eig was working on a big biography of Ali and just pointed out to us that while there had been great films about Ali, there'd never been one that tried to cover his whole life, all the different threads in his life, in one place, in one story, in one telling. And we felt like this was an amazing opportunity to weave all of those threads together, to understand him not just as a boxer, but as a man on a spiritual journey, to understand his family life, his childhood, his draft resistance, and really his place in American society. As you point to in that David Remnick quote, he's reminding us that I think for many of us, especially those of us who were too young to have watched his fights and remembered that period of his life, we think of him in that 1996 Olympics moment or in his later life, his post-boxing life, as this figure who is beloved around the world. And we don't always remember just how he was thought of in these other parts of his life and how much that evolved, how much we evolved in our thinking about him. And so telling his story in this way gives us this chance to look at the larger picture of it, how he fits in to this incredibly complicated part of the 20th century. We do forget, I think, today sometimes how hated he was at times during his life for a variety of reasons. First, you know, the white sports writers who didn't like him because he bragged too much. He didn't behave the way they expected a heavyweight champion, especially a black heavyweight champion, to behave. They wanted someone like Joe Louis again. And then he was hated and frankly feared because of his membership in the Nation of Islam, which was seen as a hate group, and for changing his name. And then he was hated for refusing induction into the U.S. military early on in the Vietnam War when the war was still quite popular. And at that point, he was really despised by a huge percentage of the American population.
Yeah, and Dave, you know, Sarah's done a wonderful catalog of the different parameters, the different dimensions of Ali's life that this film takes up. Let's talk about the bragging. People gave him all sorts of nicknames because of it. There was this outrageous level of self-confidence and self-promotion and talk about self-awareness. I wonder, you know, talking from the beginning of his career, I am the greatest, you know, we would hear from him all of the time. Was there any model for that? Was there any reason for Cassius Clay at that point in the beginning of his career to take up that, perspective, that way of promoting himself?
Well, I think, Tom, that there was Jack Johnson, who was a bit of a bragger, and there's a tradition in the African-American community of playing the dozens, but the heavyweight that was most prominent before Muhammad Ali was perhaps Joe Louis, who, maybe because of Jack Johnson, was told by his white handlers to always be polite and to never make a big splash and not to be a braggart. They feared that he would maybe not have a chance at first to fight for the title and maybe not have a chance to defend it. And so I think that's what the white sports writers and a white mainstream and a white boxing establishment had become accustomed to when Muhammad Ali arrived. But he was a born promoter. By 12, when he started boxing, he was going door to door and letting everybody know that he would be in the Friday night fights and that they should tune in and watch. That was the local Louisville station that would broadcast fights, amateur fights on Friday nights. And he just went from there. And later promoters would say that he would do the job better than they could ever do it of promoting his own fights. And he had a knack for framing the fights and making them about something more than a boxing match. And so if he was fighting Floyd Patterson, he could make it about a clash between Islam and Christianity. Famously against Joe Frazier, it became about who was more authentically black. And he did that in a way that was often racist. He spoke about Joe Frazier in terms that a white racist would use to talk about black people, but he would draw eyeballs to the fights and he perhaps would undo his opponents psychologically before they ever stepped in the ring. And so he was very unique, but he was set against the 1960s when it was a transformative time. And we could debate whether or not he was driving the culture or the culture was pushing him. This was also a time when he was crafting a persona. And so he's drawing from gorgeous George Wagner, the wrestler, who was bombastic and curled his hair and wore lipstick and called himself pretty. He's drawing from Sugar Ray Robinson, who was not a conventional. He did not box in a style that would a conventional heavyweight would have. He danced, he moved around the ring, he was light on his feet. He was maybe drawing a little bit from Little Richard. And so he's cultivating a style, he's creating a sort of public persona. He's trying to draw people to his fights and he's getting in front of the press and he's talking to them in ways that they were not accustomed to being spoken to. And for an old guard, that made them uncomfortable. And they wrote some pretty awful things about him at times and gave him nicknames such as the ones you suggested. And for a younger part of the press corps, and I think that's represented well in the film by the journalist Bob Lipsight, Dave Kindred, and also Jerry Eisenberg, they were really taken by him. He represented a new day. And over time, I think a lot of people warmed to him. He was such a quick wit. And that maybe you were annoyed by the talking at first, but you kept returning. And after a while, you came to like it. And so he was a natural promoter and knew how to draw eyeballs to his fights. And he was very good at psyching out his opponents in advance of them. And that was due to his quick wit and his comfort in front of the cameras.
That's David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns. They have made a wonderful film on Muhammad Ali. It's going to be aired in four parts on PBS beginning Sunday evening. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking calls and comments today. And Sarah Ali said at one point, "I'm the best friend a reporter ever had," because he did, in fact, give great copy to reporters. I wonder, was he the best friend a documentary filmmaker ever had? Given the fact that, you know, there's so much was written about him, so much was out there in the public domain about him. Is there a danger that people think they know him because he was such a part of American culture for folks of a certain age for so long?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He definitely was the best friend I think a documentary filmmaker could have. We were really blessed to have just this extraordinary wealth of material to work from in bringing his story to life. He did not shy away from the cameras ever. He was always happy to talk to reporters, and they in turn had great interest in him. And for periods of his life, just followed him absolutely everywhere. And so there are times when you can go back into newspaper records and find coverage of him every single day, where he was and what he was doing. And there's incredible amounts of archival footage of him talking, speaking his mind. And so it gives us this opportunity to get to know him really well, better than we can for most people. I mean, he must be one of the most well-documented people of the 20th century. And so we had so much to work with. I do think you're right that there is, you know, some people feel like they already know the Muhammad Ali story. But the great thing about having so much material on him is that there's also lots of material that people haven't seen before. And so in our process, our archival team that dug up the footage and photographs from all kinds of sources, the places you would expect, and also turning over every rock and trying to find, you know, the neighbor from Louisville's 8mm home movies that have never been transferred before, or the film, 16mm color film of the third Frazier fight, The Thrill in Manila, that had never been transferred before, that is just gorgeous, and a perspective on that fight that even if you know that fight, you've never seen before. And so that's a really exciting part of what we do, and a part of our process is that digging, that deep dive, both in terms of the story, trying to find, you know, important parts of his story that maybe haven't been excavated in some way, and also this material. And it gives us a chance to get to know him in a really intimate way, because we can hear from him on all manner of subjects. You know, often in my dad's films and other biographies, we would have an actor read things that were written by our subject in order to have their voice in the film. We did not need that in this case. We have so much of Ali talking, expressing himself, that he can do it himself. And that's the best.
And Dave, what did you determine were the deficits in terms of what people should have known but didn't know about Ali when you looked at this incredible treasure trove of material that you collected? I would just say, for me, it was his relationship to the Nation of Islam. Now, I wasn't a boxing fan when I was a little kid. I'm in my mid-60s, and so he was a prominent figure while I was growing up. I didn't follow boxing all that carefully, and I didn't follow him all that carefully, but I still felt like I knew something about him growing up and through my, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. But was there a particular place, as Sarah has mentioned, you know, you were looking for those things that people didn't know about Ali. Can you put your finger on what you identified those things were?
Well, as Sarah suggested, there are many beautiful films out there on Muhammad Ali. And that cover a chapter in his life or a battle with the United States government over his refusal to be inducted into the U.S. Army. So there are lots of pieces out there, and we were trying to put them all together. But I like to think of it as we got underway with this, or I think we discovered, and then I think it helped to see it this way, and you just alluded to this in his membership in the Nation of Islam, as a lifelong spiritual journey. And so as and his activism, his boxing career, it's informed by his faith at every turn. And I don't think I had appreciated that. And it was a good way for us to think about the life. And so as a teenager coming up in segregated Louisville, with a father who is a painter and gets work painting signs, but can't do much else because of the color of his skin, a father who tells him, you know, you're not going to earn a lot of money. You can't because you're Black. A childhood where he can go and look through a chain link fence as white kids enjoy rides at an amusement park that he doesn't have access to. The Nation of, he hears the record by Louis Farrakhan, then a Calypso performer going by not yet even Louis X. It's a white man's heaven is a Black man's hell. And he hears this record and he becomes interested in the Nation of Islam. And I really think it helped for him make sense of the segregated world that he lived in. And he was drawn to its messages. And it started for him a lifelong journey. And now the Nation of Islam is a separatist sect. And it's sometimes, we think of it as it's sort of theologically distant from mainstream Islam, but it was its leader, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, was pulling Black men who were down on their luck and had been oppressed and had no opportunities, in some cases out of the gutter or from prison, and giving them a sense of dignity and helping them find work and giving them a community to be a part of, a community that told them that they were worth a lot. And so it was a message that really impacted him. And so at times across his young life, in the spotlight as the heavyweight champion, because he doesn't make mention of the fact that he's part of the Nation of Islam until after he wins the heavyweight title. I think there was a clear understanding in his corner that if he did go public as a member of the Nation of Islam, he probably would not have a chance to fight for the title. And so he withheld that, even though people had a suspicion that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. But it is the morning after he defeats Sonny Liston that he says to a reporter, I am a member of the Nation of Islam. And he makes a declaration at that point in front of the cameras where he says, I don't have to be who you want me to be or think what you want me to think. I'm free to be who I want to be. And from that point on, he is committed publicly as a member of the Nation of Islam. And soon after that, Cassius Clay becomes Muhammad Ali. Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, gives him that name. And he does at times seem to be echoing what Elijah Muhammad's positions are in the issues. And so Elijah Muhammad was a draft resistor and went to jail during the Second World War. Well, a day after Muhammad Ali's draft status is changed and he's eligible for the draft, and after he has a meeting with Elijah Muhammad, he's speaking very thoughtfully and very eloquently about the reasons why he will not join the U.S. Army and go to Vietnam to fight poor, oppressed brown people when he doesn't get the freedoms and opportunities that he should be afforded as an American citizen in his own country. And so if you stay with it into the 70s, the Nation of Islam becomes a little less menacing in the eyes of the American people. Elijah Muhammad dies and his son Wallace Muhammad takes over the Nation of Islam. He changes the name and moves the organization more towards a mainstream Islam. And that was a place that Malcolm X, in his own faith, was going when he was leaving the Nation of Islam and was assassinated in the mid 60s. And the version, Wallace's version of it, which echoes a little bit how Malcolm was speaking at the time before his assassination, is a version of Islam that makes more sense to Muhammad Ali. It's more open. It is does not identify devils by the color of their skin any longer. And Muhammad is a man with such a big heart. This version of the faith makes much more sense to him. And if you go beyond the boxing career, after he retires when he is stricken by Parkinson, his life is consumed by his faith for the remaining decades. And he travels to the Muslim world frequently. And when he goes to the Muslim world, he's treated by the whole country as a hero. I mean, he could stop traffic in New York, but he could bring a whole country to a halt overseas when he arrives, especially in the Muslim world. And so I didn't know this about him. I was unfamiliar with the spiritual journey that he was on, but you can see it at every turn. You can see it when he prepares for a fight. In the corner before the first bell, he says a prayer. Afterwards, he thanks Allah and he talks about the fact that he doesn't need to box, that this may be his last fight. Now, I don't know how much he means that, but you can't doubt the authenticity of his beliefs. And we know that because he was prepared to give up his career and not go to the U.S. Army. And he was doing it on religious grounds. And so this is all to say that at every turn, you can see how his life is informed by his faith. And we thought that seeing this as a spiritual journey would help people see him in a new life. And it was important for us then to get perspective from people who have thought about his life, but maybe had not been heard publicly on him, that could shine a light on this spiritual journey.
Documentary filmmakers David McMahon and Sarah Burns, along with Ken Burns, were talking about the film that they've made on Muhammad Ali. We'll have more with Sarah Burns and David McMahon after this quick break. Our show was pre-recorded, so we aren't taking any calls today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, assessing the effectiveness of violence interruption programs. Organizations like Safe Streets and ROCA are central to the Scott administration's strategy to reduce violence on Baltimore's streets. But how successful are programs like these? I'll talk about it with Dr. Jeffrey Butts of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Amos Gelb of Baltimore Witness. That's coming up Monday on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guests are the filmmakers Sarah Burns and David McMahon. We're talking about the new four-part documentary that they've made with Sarah's father, Ken Burns, on the legendary fighter Muhammad Ali. A reminder that because our conversation was recorded earlier, we aren't able to take any calls or emails today. We are happy to hear from you on Twitter, at Midday, WYPR. So, Sarah, I want to talk about his Muhammad Ali's work in the civil rights arena. We were talking before the break. Dave mentioned, you know, his comment to a reporter, "I don't have to be who you want me to be. I can be who I want to be." So many African-Americans related to that. So many black folks just, you know, that resonated with black folks. That, so in a way, the bragging, the outrageousness was a point of honor for him, whereas for many white commentators, it was, oh, he was, you know, full of himself. But he really did challenge the white community about prejudice and bias, and he also changed the way that athletes participated in that conversation, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's one way to look at that bragging and his rhymes and all of that and see ego and narcissism, but I think that it's so much bigger than that, because I think you're absolutely right that when he said, "I'm the greatest, I'm beautiful, I'm so pretty," he was also telling other people, other black people, that they were too, and that they could take pride in that way, in the same way that he was. And so I think that's hugely meaningful for him to do that. He's not just talking about himself when he does that. And I think it's clear in the way that a lot of people reacted to him that that gave them a lift. And that's a really important part of his influence and his impact. But it is interesting because he does not fit neatly into an idea, our idea of the civil rights movement. And so he certainly, we can think of him as an activist. I think he's has important connections to the Black Power movement, the Black Pride movement. But, you know, he's actually at odds with the civil rights movement, the kind of Southern agrarian, nonviolent civil rights movement of Dr. King and so many others, because he is part of the Nation of Islam, a separatist group. I mean, there's a clip in our film where he is talking to the journalist Bud Collins, and he says that he agrees with a lot of what George Wallace says. You know, he's pro-segregation in that moment. And you go, what? But that is where he was in terms of his belief in the Nation of Islam and their message about separatism and black businesses and black ownership. And so he really is at odds in a lot of ways with the civil rights movement, the integrationist civil rights movement. But there are these ways that he is hugely important as an example for his courage, for what he's prepared to give up when he refuses induction. And he and Martin Luther King Jr. certainly find common ground in their views on the Vietnam War. And so they actually have this meeting and talk about that. And you see that they are, even though they differ in a lot of ways, and certainly religion is one of them, that they share this common belief that the war and that the draft is wrong. This is right around the time of King's famous Riverside Church speech. And then there's also the way that Ali is incredibly influential in terms of athletes, and not just athletes, but certainly athletes protesting, making their voices heard, using their platforms to speak for others who don't have that kind of platform ever since then. And I think that all of the athletes that we're seeing today who are protesting, who are supporting important causes, who are backing Black Lives Matter, who are making these different kinds of stands right now, are all on Ali's shoulders.
And let's listen to a clip. This is Ali talking about the different perceptions of white and black and the way whiteness is treated in American society and the way blackness is treated as well.
I always wonder why Miss America was always white. All the beautiful brown women in America, beautiful suntans, beauty shapes, all tight complexions, but she always was white. And Miss World was always white. And Miss Universe was always white. And then they got some stuff called White House cigars, white swan soap, king white soap, white cloud tissue paper, white rain hair rinse, white tornado flow wax. Everything was white. And the angel food cake was the white cake, and the devil food cake was the chocolate cake.
Yeah, and Dave McMahon, as eloquent as Martin Luther King Jr. was, or Malcolm X was, you know, there's a certain, you know, sense to what he is saying. He's talking in a way that people could easily relate to.
Yeah, and he's funny, and he's charming, and he's refreshing, and we see from the time that he is reviled for his association with the Nation of Islam and for his refusal to be inducted into the army, a kind of evolution that takes place, because he continues to be out there front and center, and he's making people laugh, and he's reflecting the times, and people continue to be drawn to him. They're also over time seeing that he was right about what he was saying, that this was not a war we should have been engaged in. And perhaps, you know, as activists come off the front lines and start getting into politics, African-American activists, they become mayors of cities, they run for Congress, the Nation of Islam seems less menacing, the people continue to warm to him. But at his core, he's a showman, and he gets as much from connecting with people as they do from him. And that's true across his entire life. And so he's sharp-witted and funny, and some of that material we were just hearing was probably informed a little bit by his association with Dick Gregory, who helped him prepare for the college lectures that he would do when he was in exile. And the connecting with the people never stops. Even as he is silenced by this brutal disease, Parkinson's, he continues to go out into the world, and with a raise of his eyebrow or a magic trick or an exchange of glances, he can give people a memory, something that they can take with them for the rest of their life. And we absolutely found that as we were researching this project and talking to a lot of people, that almost anyone who encountered him remembers every detail of that brief encounter that they had. And they've been telling that story ever since. And so whether it was with his quick wit or with a magic trick or just an exchange of glances, this was a man who left his imprint on everybody that he encountered.
If you've just joined us, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests are the filmmakers Sarah Burns and David McMahon. Their four-part documentary on Muhammad Ali airs Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights on PBS. They made it with Sarah's father, Ken Burns, and it is a fascinating and completely compelling film. And Sarah, the Nation of Islam, that relationship was sometimes pretty rocky. At one point, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad cuts off Muhammad Ali, strips him of his Muslim name, right, expels him and all that stuff. There was almost competition, I guess you would call it, between Muhammad and Malcolm X over then Cassius Clay. Yet through all of this, the Nation of Islam was very much involved in the business side of Ali's fighting career. I mean, his manager was the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, even after a schism happened between the Nation of Islam and Ali. So it's a complex relationship, isn't it?
It definitely is. And there's certainly some contradictions in there in terms of Elijah Muhammad's relationship to Muhammad Ali. So you're absolutely right. He cuts him off at one point as sort of officially as punishment for something that Ali had said about when he was in exile about wanting to get back in the ring and to fight in order to pay his bills, which went against Elijah Muhammad's teachings that Allah would always provide. And so was setting a bad example in Elijah Muhammad's eyes. The Nation of Islam also officially frowned upon sports. The organization, the religion, was about this idea of creating your own businesses and working hard, and sports and entertainment were seen as a kind of distraction. And so it was a complicated thing again, because for Elijah Muhammad, having Muhammad Ali in the fold, this incredibly famous man, the heavyweight champion of the world, is potentially a great benefit to the religion, to the membership, right? He can draw people in. He's so charismatic. He's a great selling point. But at the same time, officially, you're not supposed to be an athlete. And so there was always that tension. And of course, in that contradiction, as you pointed to, Herbert Muhammad, Elijah's son, is Ali's manager through a huge part of his career and is pocketing huge sums of money off of Ali's fights. He's taking a third of his earnings from the fights, and that's going back into the Nation of Islam, along with lots of money that Ali was giving to the nation. And so there was always that conflict. But even when Elijah Muhammad banished him and supposedly took away his name, I'm not sure how much, I mean, it had some impact, certainly. He was not welcome for a time kind of publicly as a member, but he continued using the name Muhammad Ali despite that. And he continued to be in touch with Elijah Muhammad and stayed in the fold in, I think, a lot of ways, and eventually is kind of let back in quietly. And so the relationship continues throughout, even when he's publicly, officially been banished. And it remains an important part of his life and his belief system. And even as Dave was saying before, when Elijah Muhammad dies, he follows Elijah's son, Wallace. And even as he takes it in a different direction, it continues to be a guiding principle in his life and for the rest of his life.
We're talking about a new film on Muhammad Ali. It's going to air on PBS beginning Sunday. It's in four parts. The filmmakers Sarah Burns and David McMahon join me. They made this film with Sarah's father, Ken Burns. Our conversation was pre-recorded. We talked yesterday, so we can't take any calls or comments. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Midday. And Dave, his relationship, Ali's relationship with the establishment of boxing was troubled, to say the least. The WBA, the World Boxing Association, stripped Ali of his title because of his association with the Nation of Islam, and then stripped it again, you know, because of the Vietnam War. He was really biting the hand that fed him on a certain level, and that never stopped him. He really was philosophically pure, if you will, in that way, is that he knew what he believed, he knew what he thought, he knew how he wanted to live his life, and he simply wasn't going to conform because the white establishment of boxing or any other establishment, the government or anybody else, was telling him he couldn't live that way after all.
Well, there's a certain hypocrisy in that too, because boxing is a sport that has been, as Muhammad arrives, dominated by the mob for decades. And Muhammad actually has a group of 11 wealthy Louisville businessmen who together create a kind of management company to support him, and they give him a contract and they pay for his travel and for all of his training. And it's a really incredible deal. And their whole idea was to keep him out of the hands of the mob. And so the fact that the boxing establishment doesn't like that Muhammad is associated early on with the Nation of Islam, or that he refuses induction into the draft, it's really just that they don't want this bombastic black man to be getting over on them. And so and again, that evolves. So he's making everybody money. He's drawing people to the fights. Boxing is a brutal sport. In the 50s, there had been boxers who had died in competition on television. People were wondering whether or not, with its mob ties and all the brutality, boxing should even be able to continue as a sport. Muhammad kind of saves it. He's a breath of fresh air. He's watching his fights. It's a thing of beauty, the way he moves around the ring. Hearing him talk about it with his quick wit and his humor, it gives the press corps something to write about. So he's kind of boxing salvation in a way. And I think he was hard to replace after he left. I mean, one of the most watched fights ever is the Holmes-Ali fight. His second to last fight, which he loses in brutal fashion, but billions of people around the globe watch it. I'm not sure that anyone paid as much attention to the fights after he left. And so even though he had these associations that the boxing establishment disliked, it was undeniable how charismatic he was, what a draw he was, and how thrilling the competitions were. And just as I said before, billions of people. It was hard to write that word when we were working on a script, because it was hard to believe that a single athletic competition could draw that crowd. But that's the kind of personality and charisma magnetism that he had. And so he was transformative for the sport.
Yeah, really transformative in so many ways. Dave McMahon and Sarah Burns, the four-part documentary on Muhammad Ali, airs Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights on PBS, and it'll be available to stream at PBS.org. Sarah and Dave, thank you so much, and congratulations on this film. It's really, really striking.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Coming up next, a review of the new production at Baltimore Center Stage. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.